This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My name is Bill McGinnis, and I'm just going to say a few remarks about Nick Spitzer, and I'd like to thank you for all coming to this Profiles in Discovery lecture that Nick is going to give today. But just to say a little bit about Nick's history at UCSD, he's been here, I think, for close to 40 years, something like that. And he's been not only a great scientist, and you'll hear about the science, and Darwin Berg is going to introduce Nick's science briefly, but he's been a terrific citizen of the university, of UCSD, for decades. And he's worked for the common good over and over and over, and oftentimes with little or no expectation of reward. And that's very admirable and been a great example for many of us in the biological sciences and elsewhere on campus. So a couple of things that he's done at UCSD, which you probably don't even know about, is there's a school across the highway called the Preuss School, Charter High School. And at one time, it was a very controversial thing that UCSD would be associated with the Preuss School. And Nick, behind the scenes, after it was, I think, voted down, maybe even, Nick, behind the scenes, did the political judo of somehow manufacturing the will of the faculty, changing opinions, and that's why the Preuss School is over there now. He also has helped found the Kavli Institute for Brain and Mind here, as well as the Center for Brain Activity Mapping, and he's been one of the people on campus who has been driving UCSD forward in the so-called Brain Initiative, the National Brain Initiative. So now I'll introduce Darwin Berg, who will say a few more words about Nick, and then we'll let Nick have the microphone.
Thanks, Bill. It's a privilege and an honor to be able to offer a few remarks by way of introduction about Nick Spitzer and his science. He's been a fantastic colleague, and I think many of us are here because of Nick, who arrived first and has done an enormous amount to make neuroscience here in this community the number one neuroscience community in the country, and I don't think that can be argued with. I know that there are many things that could be said, and Bill said some nice things about acknowledging the tremendous contributions Nick has made to the university, and he's done that at many levels. I want to talk about his science just a little bit before he comes to the stage and say one of the particularly remarkable features of his science again and again is his ability, his willingness and his ability to take on hard dogma in the field and turn it upside down, show how it's wrong, come in with what's right. Classic in that is what he's going to talk about today. I remember when I first got in this field, and for many of us old-timers, it was absolute dogma that when a neuron, that critical cell in your brain, when it was born, it was hardwired from the moment it was born, destined to make one signaling molecule, that transmitter. That's it. Turns out, that's completely wrong. Nick was a person that first tumbled to that, who had the insight, and then the drive and the imagination, the ability to do the experiments, to show everyone that's wrong. You can take a cell that you thought was destined to be red, you can make it blue. It can do something totally different in the circuit. And now the entire scientific community agrees with him. Now that's a feat. I could go on, but I don't want to take more time. Let me raise a question, and that is, in looking at his early career, could one have seen this talent, this ability coming forward? Well, let's have a look. I don't know. Do you see it in his eyes? He said, maybe. Well, maybe we need to fast forward just a tad. I mean, do we have here the ability, the instincts to climb that highest peak, that new knowledge, the new frontier, climbing? And yes, we do. Here is the near annual ski trip across the Sierras that Nick makes, and I think we're seeing ever more challenging heights that he's climbing to. And I might mention, I didn't intend to mention this, but I can't resist, he's not alone. This has now moved to his family, his wife, as we speak, and his daughter, both down in Brazil, just won medals in Taekwondo. His wife just won a gold medal. So I think he's inspiring everyone around him. Nick, please join me in welcoming Nick Spitzer to the microphone here.
Well, thanks, Bill and Darwin, for that generous, if somewhat revealing introduction. This is certainly an energized and exhilarating day with the announcement this morning that I'm sure you all heard of the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine to John O'Keefe, Maybrit Moser, and Edvard Moser, all of these people, good friends of many of us here in the community, for their discovery of the brain's navigation system, the GPS, as we're hearing, in the brain. I'd point out that it's also a Nobel Prize for place cells and grid cells and for the hippocampus itself, and we should celebrate that too. Now, the brain has evolved in order to sense and track the environment, and this has taken place, of course, over eons of time. However, when the brain changes in this way over time, we have to remember that when the environment changes acutely, the brain changes also. And this is brain plasticity, and it illustrates how the brain is truly an ever-changing structure. Now, there are, in addition to the Nobel Prize, there are many other reasons to get excited about neuroscience today. And this is particularly for the younger folks in the audience here, but we now have, as you know, a National Brain Initiative. Bill mentioned this. In addition, here we've got in California the California Brain Initiative. And on the UC San Diego campus, with the Kavli Institute for Brain and Mind, the Center for Brain Activity Mapping, we're forging new research directions thanks to the support of Chancellor Pradeep Khosla. And engineers, chemists, pharmacologists are partnering with neurologists and neuroscientists to build new tools. And these new tools are going to be having a profound effect on our discoveries over the next few decades. But more than that, I think that these new neurotechnologies will lead on to the foundation of companies. This will stimulate the economy. This has very far-reaching impact beyond what we all do in our laboratories. So I'm glad to have this opportunity to be here today to reflect a little bit on the past, tell you where we've been, tell you what we're doing now, and also where we're going. And I think it's fair to say that careers in science are really focused on the problem of discovery as a function of time. This is what we want to understand. And typically, careers in research are very highly branched structures. Very difficult to predict at the outset which branches are going to be productive and which branches are going to be less successful. But characteristically, they begin ambitious, bold, visionary. And this leads on, of course, to some success and inevitably some failure, perhaps not in the proportion that I'm suggesting here. So in the process of discovery, I developed a few ideas when I was still a postdoctoral fellow in London and thinking about my new job here. I'd been offered the job. I'd accepted the job. I was coming to La Jolla. It was very exciting. And I thought a little bit about what would be important for success as a new faculty member starting my own laboratory. And the first thing that seemed important to me was to think hard about the strategy for selecting the scientific problem. This is a very important issue. This will guide a lot of what happens subsequently in our careers. And what I thought was that it was important to pick a problem that's at the interface of two disciplines that have only recently come in contact, sort of like tectonic plates that floated together now and were bumping up against one another. The tools of each discipline are going to be new to the other, and new observations are going to crop up as a result of this new interface for discovery. Moreover, there would be less competition for rapid advances because it's a new area. It's not crowded yet. For me, this interface was the interface of neurophysiology and developmental biology. I loved neurophysiology. This started when I was an undergraduate in John Dowling's lab at Harvard. I enjoyed recording the electrical activity, the action potentials, the impulses in neurons. It just fascinated me. I loved doing it. On top of that, I was very intrigued by developmental biology. This is a very interesting field. As we know, this involves the process of sequential gene expression. But one of the big puzzles is, how is the expression of those genes regulated? And it seemed to me that the electrical activity of the brain, nearly unique in this fascinating organ that we have, that activity might be important in driving the sequence of gene expression and the assembly of the nervous system. It also seemed to me that the tactics for the program were going to be important, and that it was important not only to jump on the newest, greatest, hottest, sexiest methods, but also to combine these with some of the older techniques. And so the model system that we started with was one that was not very popular in neuroscience at the time, the Xenopus frog embryo, but it had several features that made it very exciting. It developed very rapidly. This is important for somebody like me. As many of you know, I'm a little impatient. So this was good. And development is external, outside the animal, so one didn't have to go in utero to get at the embryonic stages of the nervous system. And the neurons were large enough to be plausibly easy to record from. So we started with Xenopus. Now we're working with mice and rats. One picks the model that's appropriate to the system, and similarly, one needs to select the suitable tools. You'll see in the course of my remarks that we're constantly changing the tools with which we pursue our science. So the other thing that I realized right at the outset, and it's been absolutely fantastic, is the importance of colleagues. You all know this. Here are my colleagues. These are amazing, wonderful people. They deserve the credit for everything that I'm going to tell you today, and I want to be sure that they get it right up front. So at the left are the students. These are mostly graduate students. There are a few undergraduates here and a couple of staff, actually, with whom I've published wonderful papers. On the right are the postdocs, a fabulous crowd. All of these people are my friends. I try to stay in touch with them. They've gone on to high ground and are doing fascinating things, many of them still in science. So these people have been very, very important, and I want to be sure that you recognize that at the outset. So here's the outline of the lecture. It's got three relatively brief parts. First, we'll focus on the development of electrical signals. I wanted to know when electrical excitability appears. This is a neuronal phenotype. It's acquired at some point during development. When is that? And what is the function of the early forms of electrical excitability? That will lead us on to the second part of the lecture, looking at activity-dependent transmitter switching during development. This is the process to which Darwin alluded, this process of changing the identity of the transmitter that neurons use. And we'll see that they do this very nicely during the course of development. That, in turn, will cue up our interest in the last part of the talk, asking about neurotransmitter switching in the adult brain, which has been an absolutely fascinating sleigh ride and continues still into the future. So when we started in the lab, Janet Lamborghini and Paolo Baccalini were my allies at the time. We found that a very simple dissection of the Xenopus embryo could reveal, now looking down on the dorsal surface of the neural tube, the embryonic spinal cord, could reveal these large neurons shown here in the midline on the spinal cord. And you can appreciate, even at the back of the room, the nucleus and the little sort of cyclopic nucleolus there at the center of the nucleus. And you can see processes emanating away from the cell bodies of these neurons. These were the primary sensory neurons in the embryo, the so-called Rohan-Beard neurons. And the beauty of this was that we could take these neurons, we could take them out and put them in culture. Here's a neuron in culture, the cell body, the axon, and the growth cone, an electrode coming in at the right. And the neurons in culture behaved largely as they did in vivo. So that was very convenient for all the usual reasons. One could do perturbation experiments in culture that would be important to do, but much harder to do subsequently in vivo. And the initial observation relatively early in my career was this: that at early stages of development, just at the time of closure of the neural tube, the neural plate, as you remember, rounds up to form the neural tube, at that time, these neurons were excitable for the first time and generated these rather peculiar-looking, long-duration, calcium-dependent action potentials. Over the course of the next day and a half, the phenotype changed completely, and now one was left with a very brief sodium-dependent action potential, much shorter in duration. So this was really interesting, and we wondered many things about this. We first got very interested in the biophysics. We wanted to know how this happened, and Diane O'Dowd and Angie Ribera came to the lab, and they recorded, using the relatively new patch clamp technology at the time, they recorded voltage-gated calcium currents, voltage-gated sodium currents, and voltage-gated potassium currents over the course of about a one-day period. So let's look at these. What we can see here is that in response to a series of voltages, the calcium currents at an early time and at a late time are not really very different. Some inactivation here at the later stages, but fundamentally very similar. Looking at the sodium current here in the middle, we can see that over the course of this roughly 24-hour period, there's an increase in the amplitude of the current. The size of the current gets bigger, but there's no change in kinetics to shake a stick at, and this doesn't look very, very profound. In contrast, when we look at the voltage-dependent potassium current shown over here at the right, the changes are extreme. Here there's a dramatic rise in the very small potassium current seen at the early stage to achieve the much larger currents seen a little after 24 hours in culture. So this was very interesting. Sean Lockery came to the lab, and he generated a computer model of the action potential using these voltage-gated currents. Now, how does one do that? Well, one takes the currents that we saw here in the previous slide and finds equations that describe these currents and then puts those in a program to generate an action potential. This was very similar, of course, to what Hodgkin and Huxley had done in the early 50s. So I want to draw your attention first to the dashed lines here, which show the conceptual wild-type action potential. The mature action potential is over here at the left. It's a relatively brief event. It goes up, and then it comes down again. The young action potential is this long one that extends over to the right here. Those are the action potentials that one gets with the wild-type currents. What was really intriguing here is that one could change lines of code in the program and in the mature action potential introduce the young voltage-dependent potassium current. And you can see right away that the thin, brief, mature action potential suddenly now becomes a much longer duration action potential with the expression of the calcium current. Similarly, in the equations in the code of the computer program, it was possible to insert in the equations for the young action potential the mature potassium current and drive the long duration young action potential down to a very brief duration event. So this was intriguing, but my father, who was an astrophysicist, maintained staunchly that one should never trust an observation unless it was corroborated by theory. And as a neuroscientist, I argued with him. I said, really, I think all theoretical observations have to be calibrated by direct experimental work. So we went back and forth on this, and it was a lot of fun. But in the context of the experiments illustrated here, what we went on to do, I won't show you the data, but we went on to identify potassium channel genes that were likely to be involved in the regulation of expression of this voltage-dependent potassium current. We then knocked them down with morpholinos to examine their consequences, and we showed that, in fact, this model received experimental support. This then raised, of course, the question about what these action potentials are doing. And we first undertake to do this, as Yulia Gorbunova found, by looking at neurons dissociated in cell culture. Here's a neuron with its cell body, its axon, and its growth cone. And it's loaded with a calcium indicator. This was in the pre-GCAMP6 era, I would point out. So this is fluo4, a calcium indicator. And what we can observe here over the course of an hour, going by in about a minute, we can observe these spontaneous transient elevations of calcium, which are propagated very rapidly throughout the entirety of the neuron. We were able to show that these are due to those long-duration calcium-dependent action potentials, which are triggered in some way, which we were able actually to work out more recently and publish earlier this year in Neuron. But these neurons are spontaneously active during this time. That was intriguing, but of course we wanted to know whether or not that happens also in vivo. And Xiaonan Gu in the lab was able to confocally image here in an optical section through the ventral surface of the neural tube, neurons again loaded with fluo4, generating spontaneous elevations of intracellular calcium that lasted about 10 seconds in duration because the calcium influx from the action potential triggered release of calcium from intracellular stores. You can see the activity is prominent along the lateral margins of the ventral surface of the neural tube, and the floor plate in the midline is quite quiet. So these were the early observations then, and we can summarize this first part of the story as a focus on the development of electrical excitability, starting with calcium-dependent action potentials, moving on to understanding the underlying voltage-clamped currents, putting these into computer models of action potential development, identifying the role of potassium channel genes, and then finally imaging spontaneous activity, both in culture and in vivo. Well, of course, then one wants to know, what about that spontaneous activity? And so it was important to do both loss of function and gain of function experiments to try to find out what they might be doing. And so Rosario De Baca, Keith Allen, and Janet Holliday in 1993 did a very simple experiment, the result of which is illustrated here. What they did was to put cells in culture, these neurons in culture, as you've seen now a couple of times, and look at them over the first day or so, and simply score the development of GABA immunoreactivity as a measure of the expression of GABA, the inhibitory neurotransmitter in these spinal cord neurons. What we can appreciate here is that in the presence of calcium, indicated by the white boxes, about 40% of the neurons in culture become GABA immunoreactive. We should have seen that as a red flag right away, because 40% of the neurons in the spinal cord are not GABA immunoreactive in vivo. But this was the culture result. And similarly, when we looked at culture in the absence of calcium over this period of time, now as the black boxes illustrate, development of GABA immunoreactivity was suppressed, very low level. Jianlong Gu in 1995, in a really elegant series of experiments, in contrast to the loss of function experiment here, did a gain of function experiment in which he imposed different frequencies of calcium transients, different numbers of stimuli per hour at the very low frequency with which these calcium transients are generated, and scored again the percent of GABA positive neurons. What we can appreciate is that the baseline here in the absence of calcium sits a little above 10% of the neurons in culture, and then at 1 per hour, 2 per hour, and 3 per hour, there's a steady increase. They're quite reliable, that then plateaus at higher frequencies. So these loss of function and gain of function experiments suggested, albeit in culture, and one, of course, is always a little nervous about one's culture data, but it was very encouraging and suggested that there might be a calcium spike dependence of expression of this particular neurotransmitter. Well, Laura Borodinsky came to the lab, and with Corey and Julia and Sharon and Janan, she actually assessed in vivo now in the isolated spinal cord the natural pattern of activity, the frequency of spikes per hour here, again, this very low frequency, in four different populations of neurons. There are only eight classes of neurons in the embryonic spinal cord, so this is 50% of the neurons that are available to study. At the left in red are the sensory Rohan-Beard neurons that we saw on an early slide. In yellow are the motor neurons. And in blue and green are the dorsal and ventral interneurons that, of course, make up a large fraction of the neurons in the spinal cord. Over the course of these stages, 20 to 28, which is a 10-hour period of development, a relatively brief period of development, we can see that the sensory neurons have a low and constant frequency of producing these spontaneous calcium spikes. Motor neurons show a relatively rapid increase after a slow start, and the interneurons, in their own way, have their own distinctive pattern. So this was very intriguing because the different classes of neurons expressed at this stage different neurotransmitters. The sensory Rohan-Beard neurons, glutamatergic, the motor neurons, of course, cholinergic, and the interneurons, glycine and GABA. So this was intriguing. What about some perturbation experiments then to test whether or not activity really is linked to the choice, if you will, of neurotransmitter? And so what Lara did was to examine the effect of overexpressing the human inward rectifier potassium channel, human KIR 2.1 here. That's a very effective way to shut down spiking activity in many neurons, and it's widely used today in many different contexts. What I'm showing you here are transverse sections through the neural tube, now at several days of development when the transmitters are all fully expressed, under the control condition. And in the two panels over at the left, we're seeing individual sections that are stained, in one case, with antibodies to glutamate, in another case, in antibodies to the vesicular glutamate transporter, and that's in red. In addition, in green, these sections are stained for HNK1. This is a surface glycoprotein that is a molecular marker for sensory Rohan-Beard neurons. And what we can appreciate is that red plus green makes yellow, so we have yellow cells here at the dorsal aspect of the neural tube, and nothing much down below. Turning to the right here, we have a section in which the cells have been stained for choline acetyltransferase, CHAT. This is the enzyme that synthesizes acetylcholine. And these cells can also be marked by LIM3, a transcription factor will be familiar to many of you. This is a transcription factor which at this stage is expressed uniquely in the nuclei of motor neurons. So because red plus green makes yellow, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 yellow circles here. Those are the four nuclei of four motor neurons present in this section. And we notice that the CHAT is here ventrally. It's not located here dorsally. However, when the activity, the spontaneous activity that you saw in the video, is silenced by the overexpression of the inward rectifier potassium channels, all hell breaks loose. You can see it looks almost like global warming here. We've got a lot of glutamate immunoreactivity, a lot of immunoreactivity for the vesicular glutamate transporter, and more immunoreactivity for choline acetyltransferase. But I would point this out for you, friends, because notice that the numbers of cells staining for HNK1, the molecular marker for sensory Rohan-Beard neurons, has not changed. And yet the numbers of cells per 100 microns of length along the antero-posterior axis of the embryo has gone up by a factor of more more than three. If we turn to the cholinergic phenotype here, once again, the molecular marker says that the neurons have retained at some level their molecular identity, but their transmitter phenotype, at least for some of them, seems to have changed. And here there's about a 50% increase in the numbers of cells that are now immunopositive for choline acetyltransferase. So this was really fascinating. And we went on to build up a story here. I'll just summarize it for you. The take-home message was that the neurons in the embryonic neural tube during a 10-hour period generate this spontaneous calcium spike activity. This is what the embryo looks like at the start point, and this is what it looks like 10 hours later, generating these calcium spikes during that time. And the real interest was that suppressing activity led to a change in the numbers of neurons expressing excitatory and inhibitory neurotransmitters. So when activity is suppressed, the number of neurons expressing glutamate and acetylcholine goes up. And the number of neurons expressing inhibitory neurotransmitter, GABA and glycine, which are in fact inhibitory at this stage in this embryo, goes down. In contrast, when activity is enhanced, just the opposite occurs. Now we have more neurons making the excitatory transmitter, glutamate and acetylcholine, and fewer neurons making the inhibitory neurotransmitters, GABA and glycine. And you reflect on that for a moment, and you think, goodness, that looks almost as though it's homeostatic. Because when activity is increased, the nervous system, when activity is suppressed, the nervous system responds by trying to boost up the activity that it generates. And when activity is enhanced, now the nervous system tries to damp down the activity that it's generating. So it looks as though it might be homeostatic. Well, this was intriguing for us, but right away it raises a question. During this time, neurons are making synapses with one another. And one has to wonder what's happening postsynaptically. If we change the identity of a neurotransmitter and the neurons now formed a synapse with a postsynaptic partner or partners, if the receptor population doesn't change, we're out of business. The synapse won't be functional. So Laura turned her attention to the postsynaptic side of the equation, looking at the neuromuscular junction. So this is just a cartoon to summarize what's a large body of data. And at the top, we see the neural tube prior to axon outgrowth. So it's really just a tube at this point. The neurons are there, but they haven't yet begun to extend their axons. And over here at the right is cartooned the chevrons of muscle cells that lie along the trunk of the Xenopus larva and tadpole. And they're color-coded here. The colors are actually not arrayed in quite this beautiful a manner for the different classes of transmitter receptors that Laura found at the level of the messenger RNA and at the level of the protein inside the muscle cells, apparently being trafficked up to the surface. Under the conditions of normal activity, normal development in vivo here, motor neurons express acetylcholine, and the acetylcholine receptors are retained and expanded on the muscle cells, and the other transmitter receptors disappear. But under the condition of suppressed activity, when activity is suppressed, now motor neurons express, in addition to acetylcholine, they express glutamate, and now the glutamate receptors are retained and expanded out on the muscle fiber, and Laura could record miniature postsynaptic currents from these muscle fibers, indicating that the receptors are, in fact, functional in the plasma membrane of the postsynaptic cells. And finally, when activity was enhanced by overexpressing voltage-gated sodium channels to increase the frequency of calcium spiking, under these conditions now, in addition to acetylcholine, the motor neurons express GABA and glycine, and now the corresponding receptors are retained and expanded out on the muscle fiber, and again, miniature postsynaptic currents were recorded under these conditions. So it appears that the receptor population changes to match the identity of the transmitter, at least in this case. So, changing in the transmitter, changing in the receptor, but all of this in some kind of an artificial system where we're manipulating ion channel activity to change the identity of the transmitter and then look at the consequent changes in the receptor population. What about natural sensory stimuli? What about something that the animal might actually encounter in its normal way of life? And to tackle this, Davide Dulcis undertook to study a particular circuit that's involved in the camouflage behavior for these amphibian larvae. Now, this is very important. We don't have to worry about this, but if you're a fish or a frog larva, you worry about this a lot because you look like a good lunch for somebody else. It's very important to be able to camouflage oneself to protect from this kind of predation. And the circuit here involves the ventral suprachiasmatic nucleus in the hypothalamus of these Xenopus larvae. And here's a cross-section through it in which we illustrate that in the core or center of the ventral suprachiasmatic nucleus, there are neurons that are stained for tyrosine hydroxylase, the first enzyme that leads on to the production of dopamine. And in the annulus here, around the core of the ventral suprachiasmatic nucleus, there are neurons that are stained for neuropeptide Y, NPY, and those are red. And this is the condition that one finds if the animal has been kept in the dark, maybe on a dark background. But if the animals are put for only 2 hours in the light, on a white background, the picture changes in a fascinating way. What Davide found was that tyrosine hydroxylase is still expressed, and dopamine also, and other dopaminergic markers expressed here in the core of the ventral suprachiasmatic nucleus. But now, in the annulus, around the core, there's some yellow neurons, indicated by the white arrows here, some yellow neurons co-expressing both neuropeptide Y and tyrosine hydroxylase, and it turns out other dopaminergic markers as well. So there seems to be an acquisition here by these neuropeptide Y-positive neurons of the dopaminergic phenotype characterized by the expression of tyrosine hydroxylase. It turns out there were serious numbers of neurons that were changing in this way. Here, Davide is plotting the numbers of tyrosine hydroxylase immunoreactive neurons per ventral suprachiasmatic nucleus under different conditions. If we look at the bars over here at the left, we can see that on a 12-12 balanced light-dark exposure, about 50 neurons in the VSC are immunoreactive for tyrosine hydroxylase. But if the animals are raised in continuous light, this jumps up much higher, perhaps 80 neurons or so. And in the presence of the dark, as illustrated over at the left here, this number drops. Very similar results, simply by putting the animal on a different background, a background of different illumination. So this was very intriguing, and Davide was able to show that this really drives the camouflage behavior. I'm not sure you can appreciate this at the back of the room, but there are actually two Xenopus larvae here. The one at the top, the dark one, has been kept for several hours in the dark before being placed here in the bright aquarium. The one at the bottom, however, is nearly invisible. If I uncover the eye spot here, now you can see it again, but if I cover it up, it almost goes away. So this camouflage is very effective for the animal. And it's driven, Davide was able to show, it's driven by those newly dopaminergic neurons in the experimental protocol. So this is very interesting. And this developmental work then led us to a series of conclusions, which I want to just go through very briefly to wind up this part of the lecture. We think we've established five different features of transmitter switching during development in this model system. And the first is that it is manifest in several different forms. It seems to involve, in some cases, the addition of a transmitter, as we just saw, dopamine to the neurons that already express neuropeptide Y, loss, as we'll see later on in the lecture, and switching of transmitters, in some cases, actually replacing one by another. So this is very intriguing. It seems to be homeostatic in the sense that it compensates for the change that's been imposed on the activity of the animal. We've been able to drive this by ion channel misexpression, but much more interesting and relevant, of course, is that it can also be driven by sensory stimulation. I'm not going to touch on it today, but we've had a close look at some of the molecular regulation here. This will come as no surprise to all of you that it involves regulation of the activity and expression of transcription factors. These are the DNA binding proteins, as we remember, that actually regulate gene expression. Importantly, the changes in the transmitter are coupled to corresponding changes in the postsynaptic receptor identity. This is obviously key. Without that, the synapse with the new transmitter won't work. And fundamentally, the most interesting thing probably is that this switch leads to changes in behavior. This then moves us a little further along in the trajectory of the career here. We've been talking mostly about calcium spike-dependent transmitter switching, receptor matching, changes in behavior. There's a whole other branch here that I'm not really going to talk about. It was fascinating. We had a wonderful time doing it. We're still interested in this. This involved another kind of calcium transients that are expressed out in the growth cone, a different set that are expressed in the filopodia, those fine finger-like processes at the tip of the growth cone, and most recently, transient elevations of cyclic AMP. And these are all involved in regulating axon growth and axon guidance, in some cases in vitro, in culture, and in other cases in the animal. But we won't say more about that today. So in the final part of the lecture, then, I want to talk a little bit about how this might apply to the adult nervous system. And the questions are pretty clear. Does this activity-dependent transmitter switching occur in the adult mammalian brain? And if it does it then lead to changes in behavior in the adults the way we saw that it does in the developing nervous system? And so to tackle this, I assembled a crack team with Davide Puyajamshidi and drew in Stefan here to guide us in our new foray into the work with now rodents, and in this case, adult rats. And the strategy for this experiment was to take these adult male rats and put them in what we were pleased to refer to as photoperiod chambers. These are really nothing more than large black boxes with LEDs that could be programmed to turn on and off at different times of day and night, and in this way provide different photoperiod exposure for the animals under these conditions. And we raised animals under conditions of a balanced day photoperiod, 12 hours in the light, 12 hours in the dark, a long day photoperiod, 9 hours in the light, 5 hours in the dark, and a short day photoperiod, 5 hours in the light and 19 hours in the dark. Now, we're diurnal animals. We really like those long summer days. That's terrific for us. But, of course, most rodents, mice and rats, are largely nocturnal animals. And for them, a long day is a bad deal. They really don't like it. It's an aversive stimulus. It's a stressful stimulus. And what we found, looking here at the paraventricular nucleus in the hypothalamus of these adult rats, immunostaining sections, one section each from an animal here, maintained for a week on these different photoperiods, was that on the long day photoperiod, immunoreactivity for tyrosine hydroxylase, a marker for dopamine in this region here right along the wall of the third ventricle, revealed very little staining. You're hard put to it to find black profiles here in this image against the blue of the GEMSA staining to just reveal the numbers of cells. However, on the balanced day photoperiod, now there are more of these black profiles. And on the short day photoperiod, which again is a more attractive environment, a more pleasant experience for the rat, now we have quite an abundance of these tyrosine hydroxylase immunoreactive neurons at this point. And using stereological methods that we learned from Stefan and his colleagues, we were able to score not only for the paraventricular nucleus in blue, but also for the lateral preoptic area in dark blue, and the paraventricular nucleus in very light blue. We were able to score the numbers of these neurons that are present in this nucleus as a function of the photoperiod to which the animals were exposed. That's quite dramatic. There were really very substantial changes here. I have to confess, I rather thought that this would not happen, that it would turn out the transmitter switching. You know, it's interesting. It's a developmental phenomenon. Doesn't show up in the adult. Afraid not. Seems to be a feature of this system. Davide went on to find that there seemed to be a reciprocal process going on at the same time. Three different sections, again, from the animals raised on the long day photoperiod, the balanced photoperiod, and the short day photoperiod. And notice that when there are very few dopaminergic neurons stained for tyrosine hydroxylase, there's an abundance of neurons that stain for somatostatin. That's on the long day photoperiod. And on the short day photoperiod, when there are a large number of neurons that stain for tyrosine hydroxylase and dopamine, there's a relative paucity of neurons that stain for somatostatin. Again, with the stereology, we can quantify these numbers. Turns out the lateral preoptic area doesn't express somatostatin, so it's not in the graph here. But the really intriguing result was that the increase that we see in the numbers of neurons that are expressing dopamine was equal quantitatively, plus minus a few hundred neurons, to the change in the numbers of neurons that are expressing somatostatin. So this was fascinating because it suggested, at least compatible, with the idea that maybe the neurons are actually switching their transmitter from one transmitter to another. Well, we developed more evidence for this in a very nice paper that we were able to publish on this subject, but we felt the need to go a little further here to really try to pin this down. And Da Meng, a fourth-year biology graduate student in the lab, has been taking this on with some of the nicest current technology. So what Da's been doing is to take a transgenic rat that expresses the Cre recombinase under the control of a tyrosine hydroxylase promoter. This is a nice transgenic line of animals. And she stereotactically injects into the brain, into the region of the paraventricular nucleus, an adeno-associated virus, an AAV, that expresses a floxed EYFP, a fluorescent protein. And of course, under these conditions, when she waits several weeks, the Cre recombinase will now unpack and allow the expression of the EYFP in neurons that are dopaminergic and have the tyrosine hydroxylase promoter to drive the Cre recombinase. So at that point, she takes these animals, now expressing EYFP and dopaminergic neurons, and moves them for a week to the long day photo period to see if she can convert neurons that are dopaminergic, expressing tyrosine hydroxylase, to neurons that are now expressing somatostatin. And the question, of course, is, are single neurons doubly labeled for EYFP, indicating that they used to be dopaminergic and now labeled for somatostatin? And the answer is very nice, and it's shown here. Over at the left, I've separated the three color channels here so you can appreciate them. In this image at the right, there are two neurons that are expressing this membrane-associated EYFP. We can see the outline of the cells here. There are two neurons that are expressing somatostatin. Somatostatin is typically packaged in storage granules, so you have that punctate appearance of these little red puncta here, indicating the presence of somatostatin. And down here in blue, hard to see, I think, in the current illumination, is the tyrosine hydroxylase immunoreactivity, identifying a neuron that's at this point dopaminergic. So let's draw our attention here to the cell indicated by the prominent white arrow. This cell satisfies the criteria. It's expressing EYFP. That tells us that it used to be dopaminergic, but now it's lost its tyrosine hydroxylase in blue. This blue here is an axon of passage going underneath the cell. And it does express a series of red granules here, as we saw over at the left, indicating that it's now expressing somatostatin. In addition, there are other cells here, and I've outlined those as well. Down here at the bottom right is a cell that's, again, been targeted by the virus. It's expressing membrane-associated EYFP, but it hasn't changed its transmitter. It's still very happy to be expressing tyrosine hydroxylase in blue. Up here is a cell that apparently was not infected by the virus, so it doesn't have any EYFP around the plasma membrane, and it's expressing somatostatin. So we're very encouraged by these results. The paper's not published yet, so Daw still has a little more work to do. But this is very exciting because we think that this demonstrates that the switch actually happens at the level of the single cell, at least assessed here in the cell body. Well, I'll just summarize then the anatomical and molecular results of this part of the story, focusing on the adult nervous system. What we think we know now is that the suprachiasmatic nucleus that provides input to the paraventricular interneurons can drive their activity, we think, and as a function of the different photoperiods, can actually change the identity of the transmitter expressed in the cell body. We've looked also at the postsynaptic receptors, obviously, as you know now, a very important part of the equation. And interestingly, there is no change that we can detect in the red somatostatin receptor population on the target cells, these cells that release corticotropin-releasing factor into the cerebrospinal fluid in the third ventricle. However, there is, as diagrammed here, a very pronounced change in the expression of the D2 dopamine receptors. When the neurons are largely dopaminergic, these D2 dopamine receptors are there, as presumably needed by the cells. And when dopamine is largely absent, these dopamine D2 receptors are very difficult now to detect. So at this point, one wonders, what about behavior? What's going on with the behavior here? And so to tackle that, we went back to Stefan, and we got the short course on how to study animal behavior in rats, as Stefan's been doing very adroitly for many years. And we learned about the elevated plus maze. We learned about the forced swim test and other tests. I'm going to illustrate for you today just the elevated plus maze here. What I'm showing you are two adult rats, one of which has been exposed for a week to a balanced day photo period, 12 hours in the light, 12 hours in the dark, and the other of which has been exposed for a week to a short day photo period with 5 hours in the light and 19 hours in the dark. This elevated plus maze is thought to be a measure of anxiety. We can see there's an open runway here, and then there's a closed runway going at right angles to it. And the animal on the balance day photo period prefers to spend a lot of its time in the closed arm of the runway. But the chap who's been on the short day photo period, very happy to be out on the open arm, very confident, cocky even, you know, jumping around, having a great old time. And when one quantifies these data, as shown down below, for the different photo periods, we can appreciate that the rat that had been maintained on the short day photo period spends a little over 2 minutes out of the total of 10 out on the open arm of the elevated plus maze. The animal on the balance day, 12-12, light dark, spends a little over a minute out on the open arm of the elevated plus maze. And the animal on the long day photo period, the stressful photo period, really puts in a very brief appearance only on the open arm of the elevated plus maze. So this is good, of course, as far as it goes, but what does it really tell us? It doesn't tell us actually that much. What we can see here is that there's a correlation. There's a correlation between the change in transmitter expression and the change in behavior, but we're, of course, interested in causation. Are there experiments we could do to actually test whether or not this is a causal connection? So I want to show you a cartoon of the experimental paradigm to illustrate what we did, because then I can show you some data, and hopefully this will convince you that actually there is a causal connection between the anatomical changes and the behavior. So the experimental design was as follows. One started with animals on the balance day photo period, where in the paraventricular nucleus there are neurons expressing both dopamine in green and somatostatin in red. And stereotactically, we infuse 6-hydroxydopamine to ablate large numbers of dopaminergic neurons. 6-hydroxydopamine is a well-known dopaminergic neurotoxin. It kills cells, and we imagine ablating major numbers of them here. We then go on to test the behavior of the animals now that they're lacking some of the dopaminergic neurons that they had before. And then we take animals that are of this status, and we move them to the short day, 5 hours in the light, 19 hours in the dark, photo period for a week to try to drive a change in their transmitter expression, trying to convert some of these neurons from red to green, from somatostatin to dopamine. And now we do the critical experiment. This is the crux of the experiment here now. And that's to test the animal's behavior after a cannula has been introduced into the brain so that we can either test their behavior in the absence of local dopamine receptor blockers or in the presence of local dopamine receptor blockers. And the goal here is to assess the behavioral contribution of those newly green dopaminergic neurons. And so we've done that, and I'll skip over the anatomy here for want of time, but just show you the behavioral results here on the elevated plus maze. You've seen this graph before, plotting the open arm of the elevated plus maze. You've seen the animals on the 12-12 light dark cycle here, sham injected, spend about a minute out on the open arm of the elevated plus maze. After they've had a serious ablation of their dopaminergic neurons, they spend very little time out on the open arm of the elevated plus maze, and they behave like the animals that have been exposed to the stressful long day photo period. Most intriguingly, when the animals are then switched to the short day exposure to try to recruit newly dopaminergic neurons, there's a partial rescue of the time spent in the open arm. Not fully back to normal, but a very substantial and significant partial rescue of this behavior. And this is specifically blocked not by cerebrospinal fluid, artificial cerebrospinal fluid, but by dopamine receptor blockers. So we interpret this to mean that there's actually a behavioral consequence of the new induction of these dopaminergic neurons. Well, this was fascinating to us, and we've begun to wonder now whether this could be related to a neurological disorder with which some of you will be familiar. This is not a disorder that we encounter very much here in San Diego, seasonal affective disorder. As you know, this is a consequence of exposure to very short, typically winter, days, long nights, and people become very seriously depressed. And the intriguing finding reported here in 2006 was that in contrast to treatment pharmacologically with agents such as fluoxetine that were occasionally effective, and in fact often effective, but often had unwanted side effects and were ineffective in other cases, that phototherapy, 30 minutes of bright white light a day, was a very effective treatment for these patients. And so natural to wonder whether or not that could be involved in what's going on here. And this could, in principle, be very simply tested by PET scanning, looking for changes in D2 dopamine receptor expression. And this is on our dance card, something that we'd very much like to do. Well, try to put this all in perspective. I think we are all here very familiar with a variety of different forms of neuronal plasticity. I just draw quick attention to what I think of as classical plasticity, starting with changes in synaptic strength. This has been very well studied, brilliantly studied by colleagues here on the campus. And for example, for long-term potentiation, Robert Malinow and his colleagues have, I think, really nailed this to the wall. I think it's very clear now that one starts with a synapse that expresses only one class of glutamatergic receptors, and then receptor trafficking introduces a second class, strengthens the synapse so that a single action potential initially producing just a single action potential on the output side now produces a series of action potentials, and the synapse has been strengthened. Changes in synapse number are also familiar to us. Changes in excitability through insertion of voltage-gated channels on the postsynaptic side, also very interesting. What we think we have here now with transmitter switching is what we're pleased to call, David and I are pleased to call, reserve pool plasticity. We think that many neurons, and we don't yet know how many, I hope to find out, many neurons already express their transmitter, just as Darwin said. And they have a day job. They're wired up. They're doing stuff. And it's very important for us. And if we lose those neurons in a stroke, we're in big trouble. So there's no ambiguity about that. But we think that many of these neurons are also, in a sense, reserve pool neurons, in that they can acquire or lose a transmitter. They can switch a transmitter. They can change from a day job to a night job. They can change what they do. And actually, the first example of this that was suggested was in the mid-1970s, a switch of neurons in the superior cervical ganglion of neonatal rat pups. In culture, it was shown by a group at Harvard that you could switch from acetylcholine to norepinephrine and back again. Very interesting, but the tools were really not there at the time to run with this and go further with it and identify its role in behavior and its role in the adult nervous system. And what we've seen here today is that we can have switch between somatostatin and dopamine in this neurotransmitter switching process. So finally, in work that's ongoing now, just the last couple of slides here, we've begun to look at this plasticity as a function of age by simply taking rats beyond the three-month period that I've been talking about so far this afternoon, 3 months of age. This is the data that we've been examining together, and look at animals at 12 months of age and then out at 18 months of age. And what we've done is to normalize the number of tyrosine immunoreactive neurons on a long day and on the short day to as a percent of those on the balanced day, 12-12 light-dark cycle. And you've seen the data over here at the left before, very prominent change in the numbers of these neurons as a function of photoperiod at 3 months of age. 3 months of age, of course, would be an adult, a normal adult rat. But by 12 months of age, the ability to respond to the short day photoperiod with an increase seems to have been largely lost. And by 18 months of age, both directions of plasticity seem to have changed. So this is work ongoing. We haven't got this all figured out yet, but it seems as though there's an age dependence to this particular kind of neuronal plasticity, at least in the adult rat. In other work, Wee-Chun Lee in the lab has been studying the effect of exercise. And as you know, I'm sure mice love to run. We put them on a running wheel here, and they just run all night long. It's quite amazing. And what Wee-Chun has been doing is to look in the midbrain. We're very interested to know about other regions of the brain where transmitter switching might occur, and focusing on the pedunculopontine nucleus, the PPN, the pedunculopontine nucleus. What she finds is that this activity leads to an increase here with exercise of expression of CFOS. What's CFOS? CFOS is an immediate early gene that's activity dependent. When your nervous system is active, more cells express CFOS. So this is telling us that indeed some cells in this region are active. And in parallel, she finds a decrease in the numbers of neurons expressing choline and acetyltransferase. So here with exercise, the number is down, and we look at the quantitative data here. We can see, yes, it's quite significant. And in contrast, the lateral dorsal tegmental nucleus, another cholinergic nucleus right next door, no significant change. So she's very interested in looking at the reversibility of this process, looking for a switch partner, and of course, most importantly, trying to identify what the effect of a decrease in cholinergic neurons here is on the motor behavior of the animal. In other work, Matt Eckler in the lab is looking at obesity, fundamentally, feeding mice on a high-fat diet and looking at changes in POMC expression in the hypothalamus. Now, POMC, as many of you know, is a large peptide. It's processed to give rise to a series of smaller peptides. Most interesting for the regulation of appetite is alpha-MSH, alpha-melanocyte-stimulating hormone, alpha-MSH. And what Matt finds, he puts the animals on a high-fat diet, indicated in red, and compares that to the food intake by mice put on the standard mouse chow. After about a week, we can see that the animals on the high-fat diet reduce their food intake, apparently balancing their energy efficiency, the amount of kilocalories that they take in. And then out at about 3 weeks, there's the weight gain begins. So we're very intrigued by what might be going on here at this very early point. And nicely, what Matt finds is when he looks at the numbers of POMC immunoreactive neurons in the arcuate nucleus down here at the base of the brain and the hypothalamus. Here's what we see under the control condition, but the high-fat diet leads to a very abrupt increase here at 1 week on the high-fat. And then this starts to decline again by 2 weeks and by 4 weeks. And the data indicate that this increase and then subsequent decrease are quite significant. So we're very interested in the same kinds of questions, the reversibility, the switch partners, the behavior. We think this is going to be a very interesting road to go down. So finally, where does this bring us? This shoots us up to the top right here, and looking at transmitter switching in the adult brain. Our objectives going forward into the future are to focus on both normal physiology, things like exercise, which we all indulge in, and also in neurological disorders, perhaps even psychiatric disorders. So that's the story. I think it's fair to say that the brain is ever-changing. It's ever-changing in the adult, not just during development. And I'm sure it's changing in ways that we have really not yet tumbled to. I think the transmitter switching process is fascinating. I think it has interesting implications for our interpretation of the connectome. Many of you know, many of us have colleagues who are embarked on the venture of mapping the connections within different nervous systems. Of course, most interestingly, perhaps our own nervous systems. This is clearly going to be very important for understanding how the brain functions. But it's going to be challenging to interpret the wiring if the wiring can stay in place, the axons and the dendrites and the synapses can remain in place, but the presynaptic transmitter can change and the postsynaptic receptor population can change as well to change the function of the cells. But there's a lot to do here, and I'm looking forward to doing it, and thanks very much for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.